Hi guys, and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And today we will be discussing Season 6, Episode 13, How About a Friendly Shrink?
Yes.
So we hope you have had a wonderful day so far. We have had a wonderful day.
Well, it's getting sunny in England.
It's getting beautiful in England and like a pleasant kind of weather. Like it's not too hot, it's not too cold. And we just put our name down for potentially buying our first house. So everybody keep your fingers and toes crossed for the boyfriends, please.
Yes, the housing stuff kind of offsets the impending doom that is climate change. So that is good.
Yes, yeah. And also, at the point of recording, today is National Bee Day, at least for the UK, can't speak for anyone else. So make sure you go out there and protect those bees, because they are our besties.
Really? The 20th of May is National Bee Day in
20th
the
20th of May is National Bee Day.
Cool.
Anyway, I will be doing the overview of the episode, and Bee will be giving us the trivia this week. So do you have anything to start us off?
Yes, I do. So How About a Friendly Shrink is the 124th episode of Desperate Housewives. It was written by Jason Ganzel, directed by Lonnie Price, and it first aired on the 17th of January 2010. So on this week, the number one song in the US was TikTok by Kesha, and the number one song in the UK was Replay by Ayaz, same as last week.
Yep.
On Monday the 11th of January 2010, Simon Cowell left the TV show American Idol, and the album Contra by Vampire Weekend was released.
Simon left American Idol in 2010?
Yeah, on Monday the 11th.
Oh my god, I didn't realise it was that early.
On Tuesday the 12th of January 2010, there was the big earthquake in Haiti, which destroyed most of the capital, Port-au-Prince.
Oh, okay, wow.
On Thursday the 14th of January, Yemen declared war on Al-Qaeda.
Oh.
And on Friday the 15th of January 2010, it was the 15th Critics' Choice Movie Awards. The Hurt Locker won Best Film over James Cameron's Avatar. That was quite big news at the time. Also, The Book of Eli and The Lovely Bones were released in movie theatres that day.
Yeah, I never finished The Lovely Bones book.
And lastly, on Sunday the 17th of January, it was the Golden Globe Awards, which saw wins for Sandra Bullock, Jeff Bridges, and the film Avatar.
Sandra Bullock, Jennifer Aniston, one of those.
Yeah. The episode title is lyrics from the song Country House, which is a song in the musical Follies.
Of course.
We've got some notable guest stars in this episode as well. So Orson's physical therapist, Joyce, is played by Patricia Bethune. I'm really sorry if I mispronounced that. I'm not too sure how to pronounce it. Bethune?
Maybe.
She is mostly known for her role as evil nurse Mary Pat on General Hospital, and she's also known for her roles in Mad Men, True Blood, and she's gained critical acclaim for her work in theatre.
Oh, okay.
Tom's therapist, Dr. Graham, is played by Jane Leaves. Jane's been in TV, film, and theatre, and is most known for her role as Daphne in the TV show Frasier. Her role as Daphne was awarded numerous award nominations during the course of the TV series, which include 1994, when she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a series, miniseries, or television film by the Golden Globe Awards. In 1995, she won the Q Award for Best Supporting Actress in a Quality Comedy Series. She was nominated 5 more times in that same category during the years. In 1998, she was nominated for the Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series Primetime Emmy Award. In 1999 and 2003, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, Television Series, Musical or Comedy by the Satellite Awards. And in 2001, she was nominated for the Supporting Actress of the Year in a Comedy Series by TV Guide Award.
Okay.
And surprisingly, you might like this, I thought that I recognised the sobbing woman at the end as Angela Kinsey from The Office, so I looked her up. It's not Angela Kinsey.
Oh.
It's actually Karen Strassman, and she is an actress known for her voice acting roles and has played video game characters such as Alexia Ashford in Resident Evil The Dark Side Chronicles, not the original Code Veronica, but the Dark Side Chronicles version. She was Princess Katana and Melina in Mortal Kombat 9 and 10, and she's Annette Birkin in Resident Evil 2 Remake. Pretty strange to find a pretty well-known voice actor as a sort of random
sobbing woman.
Sobbing woman in
a show.
And sure
it was definitely her?
Yeah, yeah. Look, she is Karen Strassman as sobbing woman.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Who I guess looks like Angela Kinsey a little bit. Who knew?
Yeah.
And finally, the canteen that Catherine sits in at the end of the show in that very emotional and lovely scene is the same one used in Scrubs.
I thought I recognised it.
Yeah.
But I'm just used to it being a lot more full.
We've seen that a lot of times, that canteen.
Yeah, we've seen that canteen on repeat. Okay, so previously on Desperate Housewives, Juanita was accepted at Oak Ridge School, which I will say now is the same school that Susan teaches at.
Mm-hmm.
Danny admits he sort of likes Anna. Brie and Orson begin the work to fix their marriage as he moves back in.
Catherine, although it's a very one-sided work.
Well, yeah. Catherine has a full-blown breakdown and has been MIA ever since, and Tom and Lynette lost a kid, but their ways of handling it don't really seem to be gelling very well.
They seem to be handling it in different ways.
Yeah. So Anna is over at Angie's with Danny for like a lovely traditional Italian dinner, and she's made a lot of food and put a lot of love and care into it, but Anna is watching her weight and is only interested in having a salad. And then she tells Angie that she wants to become a model, so she has to be careful, and she's not really interested in going to college because as soon as she finishes high school, she's moving to New York. And then Angie, doing what mums do, start judging the thought process of the young person with dreams and goes on to say, oh, okay, well, you know, you've always got porn.
Yeah, specifically judging the model lifestyle and career as well, right?
Yeah.
Which was quite a common thing back then.
It was a common thing back then.
It's another one of those instances that, and we saw this in the last episode as well, where people seem to be confusing career paths. Like, you know, we had the strip club being confused with being a prostitute, and now we've had being a model being confused with a prostitute or going into the porn industry.
Or, you know, being addicted to drugs or, you know, what have you. So also, if I was Anna, I'd be like, great, thanks for your opinion, but you're not my mum.
Yeah, and not every career path that isn't STEM related leads to porn and prostitution.
No, but at the same time, I did feel for Angie putting in all the effort on that food and making a lovely dinner, and they're both, Anna and Danny, are like, no.
Carbs.
Yeah, just gonna have salads.
Yeah, I did note that. I get why she's a little bit annoyed that she put so much effort into all this food and they don't want to eat it. But I did also think, like, from an outside of the television perspective in real life, how did it not come up before the meal started?
What?
You're cooking for someone that you've never cooked for. You didn't want to know if they were vegetarian, if they had allergies, if they're gluten intolerant, anything.
Yeah, because she is like, I don't eat carbs. So it's not like she's just saying, oh no, I'm just watching my weight, blah, blah, blah. Which she did also say, to be fair, but it's not like it's just that. She is saying, I don't eat carbs, which sounds like it's a conscious choice you made quite a while ago to cut carbs out of her life. So you would have thought that that would have been relayed to Angie.
But also, Angie, from a TV perspective, is a stereotypical Italian lady. She's not going to know what to cook that doesn't have carbs.
No, because Italian food is quite carb heavy, you know, pastas and cheese.
Especially in this show.
Yeah.
She's all about her pastas and potatoes and pizza and, well, not her, but just Italian food in general in this show.
Is cheese a carb? In this scene, Anna essentially also tells Angie that she thinks that Danny should come with her to New York to pursue his poetry, which then also takes Angie by surprise because she clearly has no idea her son writes poetry, and neither do we until now.
Yeah, she's like, oh, it's amazing, isn't it? And Angie's just like, I wouldn't know.
I'm too busy cooking food, no one's going to eat.
Oh, bless her.
So later on, Angie pops by Lee's to drop off a parcel, which we can assume is a gay thing because that's the way that the scene implies it to be. And then they see Danny and Anna in the distance, and Angie admits that she does not approve of this coupling and she will do what she needs to ensure that it doesn't continue, and they end up like consciously uncoupling, or whatever the phrase was.
Yes. Lee's kind of great in this scene, I'm not going to lie.
He is, yeah. So, but Lee helps her realise that if she tries to break them up, then it will just more than likely drive Danny towards Anna and away from her. So she now sort of has to start learning to just be Anna's friend.
Yes.
And make peace with the fact that she can't control who her son gets with.
Yes, it's really nice to get some more sort of material from Bob and Lee as well. That isn't just about them being the gay couple or whatever.
Yeah. So Angie takes this information to heart and she takes Anna out to go shopping, where Anna is a bit bitchy, but Angie wants to get to know her. But Angie doesn't believe Anna's good for Danny because he's been through a lot, and so he needs someone that won't hurt him. And this is when Anna chimes in to say that she can relate to Danny because she used to feel like him too, and that's why she likes him, because she knows how he feels. She reassures Angie that she won't hurt Danny, but that she'll essentially just have to trust her.
Yeah, it's a horrendously awkward scene at the start.
Yeah.
And I sure do not blame Anna for the way she's acting, considering the way that Angie acted earlier.
Yeah.
I also felt quite bad for Anna because everyone has told her so far that they're worried that she's just going to hurt Danny's feelings and treat him the way that she treats boys in general.
Yeah, Julie said that to her. Angie said it.
Yeah, and I reckon because she seems to have actual feelings for Danny, it must be a little bit hurtful.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, look at Anna and judge based on looks. Like, oh, she's that skinny, pretty girl. She's only out for a laugh. She's not taking this seriously.
I mean, considering that we haven't really seen her date or go out with any boys anyway, we've seen her use the twins for all that they're worth, but, you know, she had chores to do.
Yeah, I know. And that was the old Anna. Even in this scene, Anna was like, I used to be like that, and I'm not anymore. And even though it wasn't like specifically stated that it's because of Gabby and Carlos's influence, I think we can safely assume that she's growing as a person because she's finally been accepted into a home and what have you. But it is a shame that we seem to have lost that connection between Anna and Gabby and Carlos.
Yeah, 100%.
And so that's Angie's story, essentially, just a little bit meh. Like, it's an average story. It doesn't really add anything.
It's just it's a middle story setting stuff up.
Yeah, essentially. So we'll do Catherine next because she's quite short. We cut to a therapist who sees all types of people, but apparently his most fascinating patient at the moment is Catherine. And she's opening up to him about how she began to fall for Mike and she was lonely and blah, blah, blah. It's really actually quite a sad story when we hear it from a sane Catherine, like someone that's, you know, mentally stable.
Yes.
They broke up and then she went back to being lonely, but this time it was harder because now she sort of had a piece of what she'd lost, like she could feel it. So she then pretended, apparently just for a moment, that Mike was with her again and she felt better. And so she kept going to that place until eventually that false narrative that she was creating for herself meant more to her than reality. But she's on her medication now and she's working on things, but I think she's essentially saying that she has to now start facing her life and how she's ruined it and she's made so many mistakes.
Yeah, that was the saddest thing for me, was just her saying that after the doctor asks if the medication is helping, and she said it's working, but I wouldn't say it's helping because it's kind of made me realize how awful what I've done is, and I thought that was very upsetting.
I thought Dana was fantastic in this scene.
Isn't she always?
Like, she is, yeah. She is, but, you know, it's not very often we get emotional scenes like this from Dana. We get them a lot from Gabby. We get them a lot from Lynette.
But what a great, truthful thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, they're making me realize how wrong what I did was, and it's kind of hard.
I thought that she acted her ass off in this scene. She was incredibly emotional, raw. I thought she was fantastic. So Catherine, being at Sacred Heart Hospital, is getting lunch in the Scrubs diner. Mm-hmm. And she turns around and she sees Karen, who's visiting her as a way of repaying Catherine for helping her a while ago.
Wouldn't you think that maybe you've taken too much medication if you just turned around and saw Karen in the room with you like that?
Well, even Catherine's like, are you crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Maybe I'm bonkers too. So she asks when Catherine is returning, but she doesn't really seem to be interested and doesn't believe the people on the lane would want her back. And then Karen tells her that she'd be surprised at how willing to forgive everyone is, but Catherine doesn't really believe her.
But it's true, she's not been there, but we've seen a lot of forgiveness in this season already.
We have, yeah.
I mean, Lynette and Gabby, all that drama.
The husbands ultimately will just do what they're told.
I don't think the husbands really care that much. The only one that's really cared about anything so far is Carlos.
Yeah, and I think obviously Mike in this instance will probably care as well, being the one that went to prison because of Catherine's actions. But all the rest of the husbands, Tom, Orson, Carlos, they'll just fall in line.
Yeah.
Finally, Catherine's sort of story arc comes to an end in this episode with Karen coming back to visit her to tell her that their last conversation pissed her off because she doesn't like that Catherine could just assume so quickly that her friends could write her off like that. And although Catherine still believes this to be the case, the ladies all turn up to tell her that they'll certainly give it a try. And with Susan obviously rocking up last for the drama of the moment, be like, oh, you know, Bree, Lynette and Gabby are all here. Where's Susan? And then Susan kind of turns up.
Yeah, it was a really heartwarming ending.
Yeah.
So
that
story.
That was the end of the episode as well, but you know, Catherine's story was short, so. Gabby has popped by Susan's classroom to see her because she's just dropped Juanita off at her first day of school. Susan asks what animal Juanita is, and all the kids are split into animal groups, so leopards, chipmunks, and giraffes. And Juanita is a leopard, which Susan doesn't react well to.
Mm.
And then she gusses that MJ is a giraffe.
Yeah.
At this school, I think all schools like this really had some sort of system like this. My junior school had it when I was at junior school. I can't remember what my junior school one was, though.
Well, in primary school, we just had colours, so it was red, green, blue, and yellow. And I was in, I think, yellow group, which I didn't mind at all. But I just thought they were randomly assigned. But It could have been based on some sort of merit. It's not really something that I particularly gel with very well as an adult, though, the idea of it.
When I went to secondary school, we had a similar sort of thing. And because I went to secondary school in Whitstable has some iconic, for lack of a better term, landmarks there, and so each of the houses within the school was based off of a landmark. So there was Harbour, Castle, Street, and Windmill. And
oh, Street kind of sucks.
We had like the Whitstable Street.
Yeah, no, but like that's so lame in comparison.
Yeah, I know. Ivor's Castle.
Well, that's probably because you know, pretty good.
Queen right here has to have a castle, bitch.
But also, Susan, you play poker with these ladies all the time, and you can't keep a straight face for a second. I bet they catch her out all the time when she's bluffing, because the minute that Gabby says Juanita is a leopard, she goes, oh. It's like,
I honestly reckon that Lynette is the best one at poker.
Maybe, but you know when she's lying.
That's true. Maybe it's Bree then.
Yeah.
So Gabby does then ask Susan which one of the advanced group is, but apparently nobody knows, not even the teachers. And the principal worries that if the parents find out, then they'll begin to get competitive, which Gabby believes is crazy. But then she starts to worry that the leopards are the morons. And so she instantly can tell Susan knows something, and Susan doesn't know for sure, but she shows some of Gabby the kids' artwork, which does clearly show a difference in artistic talent, which I will state right there. But, you know, artistic talent means nothing when it comes to intelligence.
Yes.
Like some people.
That's why I believe there are different groups for different classes by the look of it, because they yes. do state later that there is a different one for reading.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Gabby seems to be taking this as, if my daughter isn't the top, then she's going to fail everything.
So Gabby takes the sort of show and tell of this artwork as confirmation that leopards are the dumb group. And then Susan starts to tell Gabby that leopards are very important for the school system, and then begins to start listing stupid tasks that they do, which doesn't really help. It's the pace, not the race.
Yeah.
Leopards are very important. They help move the cafeteria tables, and they're excellent door holders. Like, what the fuck?
I think you probably know this scene really annoyed me, because I thought, what the fuck is this school doing putting the kids with, like, perceived lower IQs as some sort of working class, labor enforced, like,
yep.
Oh my god, like, they're the ones that have to move shit in the cafeteria, they're the ones that hold doors for the cleverer people, what yeah. the hell?
And don't get me wrong, I don't necessarily disagree with the fact that kids at a school should maybe do stuff like that. I had to do that at school, but it wasn't the smart kids got to stand and watch the dumb kids move the benches, like...
Yeah, which is kind of what's implied, because it's not like she said that everyone does a bit of everything.
No.
She just said, don't worry if they're dumb, they're helpful at least.
Yeah, I know. She was like, oh, they're vital to the school's ecosystem. No one would have anywhere to sit if it weren't for the dumb kids.
Yeah, I know. Who knew Susan was such a Tory?
I She's know, like, what the fuck?
She may not have the, they may not have the IQ because they can't afford the education, but we can use their arms.
They'll be good at labour work.
Yeah.
So obviously this doesn't really help Gabby, and she goes to speak to Principal Hobson about moving Juanita, because there must have been some mistake.
Oh, the poor headmaster.
Yeah, I know. Principal Hobson's got no idea what he's let himself in for. Gabby is talking to the principal about different groups and wanting to know whether she should just write Juanita off now in life.
yes.
But he refuses to tell her, and she eventually leaves, and that's when she bumps into Juanita and her friends, who are all in different groups. So she gets a photo of them with their maths homework, and leaves the kids thinking that she's a bit weird.
Yeah, that's really embarrassing. Really messy behavior.
Yeah, I know. And then one of the girls is like, your mom's weird.
Yeah. And Juanita's like, you're telling me, or whatever she says.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. That's so embarrassing.
Now, Gabby is talking to Carlos about the math homework, and they celebrate because they figured out Juanita is actually in the advanced class based on the image of all of the different homeworks that they've got.
Which is the most unbelievable thing about this entire episode, that she took a picture on that old-ass Nokia, like, Sony Ericsson, whatever kind of potato phone that is.
Yeah.
And she thinks that she can sleuth on some homework on that.
Right, the Kelly Rowland Dilemma music video phone.
Yeah, as if.
But Gabby now can't help but feel bad for Susan, who was so sure that MJ was the advanced one, but Gabby's now got proof that Juanita's actually the smart one, which means that actually, maybe Gabby should be the teacher and not Susan. Carlos tells Gabby not to tell Susan because they've had enough drama lately, and she begrudgingly agrees.
Very begrudgingly.
A bit later on, Susan pops over to Gabby's to give her some of MJ's math books to help her catch up, and we have a clip.
Hey, Susan, what's up? I was going through some of MJ's stuff, and I found these math workbooks from last year. I thought Juanita would find them helpful. Well, thank you. No problem. I thought it might help her catch up. Catch up. Yeah, you know, from when she was out of school. She was never out of school. I was homeschooling her. And I know you did the best you could. But now she has professional teachers, and I bet she's going to catch up to MJ in no time.
I love that the bumbly music started playing right after that condescending little comment there.
Yeah, I know.
And I know that you did the best you could. Talking to her like she's a child.
So Gabby then tells Susan that Juanita's group is actually the advanced one, and MJ better start practicing moving those cafeteria tables.
Yeah, and Susan doesn't seem to take that very well.
No, she doesn't. And Gabby leaves being like, but please don't tell anybody, because you know how competitive parents can get.
Yeah, it's all well and good being like, it's not about who's the best and who's the cleverest. It's about taking part when you're on top.
Yeah.
But as soon as you're not on top, fuck that. I want to win.
So now we get a chaotic scene. This is like the chaotic scene of the season, I think.
It's the best scene of the season.
So MJ's eating dinner and Susan's watching on, depressed that her son's a moron because he can't tell his left from his right so easily. And now what I will say is that just because he can't tell his left from his right very easily does not mean that he is a moron, okay? I am not a leopard or a giraffe or whichever one the worst one is, just because I have to put my hands by my side and make the little L sign to figure out which one's the left and which one's the right, okay, bitch?
Yeah, you definitely have chipmunk behaviour. But I don't really think that was the problem.
Chipmunk's the average one.
That's what they think. But yeah, I don't think that was really the problem. I think the problem was that he wiped the wrong side of his mouth and then she said, no, you're right, and he wiped his forehead.
Yeah.
I think that was the real problem.
That was the real problem,
and
yeah.
And then she just goes, oh, as if she's going to break down and in tears.
So Susan then grabs Mike and tells him that she loves MJ and is worried that he might be Forrest Gump. But Mike assures her that he isn't. And then they see MJ getting his hand stuck in a glass, which they then watch from the window to see how MJ will resolve the situation.
It does take him a while.
It does take him a while to pull his hand out of the glass.
Because he doesn't put the other hand on the glass and pull his hand out. He just starts...
like shaking the hand with the glass on it to see if he can like shake it loose.
I did kind of wonder if he was going to smash it.
Yeah, I know. I was waiting for it.
But also, what kind of adults are letting children his age have glass?
Yeah.
I had plastic cups.
Oh, well, I'm guessing he's, what, 7? Yes, yeah. Because him and Gabby were pregnant around about the same time-ish. So, yeah, 7 MJ will be. But still, yeah, I'd say plastic's good enough for a 7-year-old.
Especially for a leopard. I don't really know why I put this here, by the way, but I might as well talk about it now. But I did write in capital letters, but why are chipmunks in the middle and not the bottom? Considering that out of those three things, you'd think they're the bottom of the food chain, right?
Maybe. I thought that giraffes were, like, the high achievers because they're, like, so tall.
So, yeah, you'd think that naturally if it was high order, that yeah, a chipmunk would be the bottom.
But I think that they've deliberately done it like this so that parents don't immediately start to think, oh, well, you know, it's obvious that this one's this because, you know, they're so... giraffes are tall or what have you.
It's just really weird.
Yeah.
Really strange.
There's no logic between the decisions of what group is what animal. There's no logic behind any of this.
No, there's not.
So this is when Susan stops a maths teacher at school to ask how MJ is doing, but she doesn't really get the reassurance she needs when she sees how the teacher delivers the news that MJ is such a joy.
Oh, you did that thing where you put your head to the side and say he's such a joy.
Yeah, no. Susan knows, as a fellow teacher, and I'm sure all of you teachers that are listening to this know that that is code for your child is hopeless.
We'll ask, Joel has a teacher friend. We'll ask her later when we see her.
Yeah. So the conversation between Susan and the teacher gets overheard by a parent who now knows the sort of breakdown of the code, the giraffe, leopards, chipmunk thing, and the information will now slowly be known by all because Susan is there saying, oh, Gabrielle Solis broke the code. Everybody knows leopards are the high ones.
Messy.
Not only does Susan announce it with another parent around, but she throws Gabby under the bus by being like, Gabrielle Solis broke the code.
Yeah, and right in front of that child who's like a chipmunk or whatever, or whatever she is.
Yeah, I know, that dumb child over there is like, oh, I'm giraffe.
This was messy, chaotic behaviour.
Gabby and Susan are at the principal's office waiting to be called in, and then Gabby apologises for getting Susan in trouble, and then they both admit they got a bit carried away.
Which was also quite funny, just seeing them waiting in the headmaster's waiting room.
Yeah, I know.
Like they're being told off, like naughty children.
They see that other kid. Why is there always at least one kid that will eat paste?
I don't know. What are you in for? Eating paste?
What group are you in? Giraffe.
Damn. Ugh. Damn. One's like, damn, and one's like, yes.
So Gabby tells her that it was so important for Juanita to do well because it's what she has to show for herself as she doesn't have a career. So if her kids succeed or they don't, it's because she raises them. And I bet you, I can guarantee you, this is because of the dream that she had in that If episode.
Yeah.
Susan then admits that she feels like she doesn't even raise MJ now that she's started this job. And then they start to joke about it and move on to reading groups with Juanita being an otter and MJ being a penguin. And then their story kind of ends with the sort of implication that maybe they're going to start this whole tirade again, but with the reading group.
Well, it'll probably never end.
No.
Even if they're not so messy about it, they'll always think about it. Yeah. Because parents probably do.
And the school will just create a new code. And also, you know, people, I was about to say ladies, but that's just my word for everybody, really. So ladies, your children aren't you, okay? So don't do a Gabby here where they're like, my child is everything. Like, that's all I've got to show for my life. No, because the minute you start putting that expectation on your child, it is unfair to your child.
Also, children are going to be good at some things and not others.
Yeah, there's no need to compare children. You know, I'm not Einstein. I'm never going to be Einstein. I was never sporty. My brother was sporty.
And I was horrendous at anything STEM, and the only thing I was any good at in school was English. But I was never very good at most things in school, and I felt like a complete dunce when I left school, but I went through university and I'm living.
I felt like a complete dunce once I went back to university.
So I don't think that judging children when they're at their youngest, they're developing, and they don't really know the value of knowledge and learning is a very smart thing to do.
No, it's also a very unfair thing to do, to write off a child so soon in life.
Yeah, and also let's remember that these arbitrary values that we're assigning them by, and the way that the school system works in general, they're not really the best way to do things anyway.
No.
Like, just let them be. They'll be fine. Just nurture what they like and let them be happy and kids.
Allow them to enjoy what they enjoy.
You can trust us. We're not parents. No, we wouldn't lie to you.
No, we'd never lie to you. And we know all about parenting. I'm the Joe Frost of the podcast world.
Yeah.
So, we'll move on to Bree now. Apparently, Orson hasn't bathed in over a week, and Bree is trying to convince him to have a bath, but he doesn't want one because he can no longer bathe himself, and he finds that humiliating. He then passes her a list of items he needs from the store, which is the same store that she went to only an hour ago, clearly trying to manipulate and control her again in his own way by making things as difficult as possible.
Yes, indeed. But also, you could just put you in the bath and then you can bathe yourself.
We might, it depends. Like, he might not be able to keep himself sat up.
That's fine by me. Let him drown.
Next day, Bree is going out all day doing errands, so Orson has to let the physical therapist in. She goes to leave, but Orson demands that Bree make him whipped cream for his waffles because apparently the strawberries won't stick to the waffles without it. Bitch, you ever heard of a fork?
This is extremely Tory behaviour.
It is real Tory behaviour. Luckily, Bree already has a bowl of whipped cream ready in the fridge.
Yeah, she must have just forgot to get out.
Probably.
Honestly, Bree, you don't have to do this. Stop being a martyr. This is not how you get into heaven.
No. So, before she hands the breakfast back to Orson, she asks him to say please, which he refuses to do, and so Bree ends up keeping his breakfast out of reach until he learns some manners and she leaves.
Good for you, girl. What a boss.
I'm sorry, it's horrid, but
it serves him right. It serves him right.
It's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
We then cut to later in the day, and the physical therapist is letting herself in because Orson's not answering the door, and we have a clip.
Well, I was trying to get those waffles, and I fell out of my chair.
What are they doing up there?
Starving him? That's ridiculous.
Really? So you don't torment him by putting food out of his reach?
Oh, well, you kind of had to be there for that.
Can someone please get me a piece of bread?
Orson, for God's sake, stop that!
Please hit me in the legs this time. There's no feeling there.
Could someone please get me a piece of bread?
I loved when she said, oh, well, you had to be there for that.
you kind of had to be there for that.
Yeah, it's not a good comeback.
So the physical therapist pulls Bree into another room where she does admit that she could tell Orson's being a bit overdramatic.
Loved that. She's like, well, yeah, he's being dramatic.
She's like, I can sense he's being a bit overdramatic. But Bree does open up to her and say, this whole thing started because he refused to say please. And then I think the physical therapist kind of helped Bree on her way to understanding that, you know, Orson's just at the moment mad at the world and taking it out on Bree. But let's face it, we as an audience also know Orson's mad at Bree.
And we also know that it's not outside of Orson's normal behavior when he feels like being a petty little bastard.
Yeah.
But when someone is mad at the world and taking out on you, that doesn't mean you have to take it as well.
No, of course not.
But also maybe don't hide food away from him.
No, and so I feel for the physical therapist here. So the next scene has Orson staring out of a window when Bree comes in, and so he demands that Bree close the door, but she refuses to because he refuses to have a bath. And so in Orson's words, I don't care.
It's basically lingo for I have depression and I'm having a moment.
Yeah.
So really, isn't it?
Bree won't accept doing anything until Orson starts to be more polite to her. And then she stops the conversation to tell him that the door stays open because he stinks. And that's when Orson calls her a whore, but at least he can get clean, which I'm sorry, is delivered so fiercely.
I wrote that too. Like, Orson saying, but I can get clean was such a burn.
It really was. He literally just went, and you're a whore. I mean, obviously I don't like Orson, but that line delivery was so fierce.
I know, he snapped it back so quickly.
Right? I can get clean.
You can clean off the stink, you can't clean off the whore.
So Bree takes this literally when Orson says he can get clean, and she drags Orson into the front yard, sprays him with the hose and washing up liquid, which I'm sure is actually some form of torture.
I'm pretty sure that hardly any of that washnup liquid went on him either, because she was sprinkling
she
it
was
around
all
and I was like,
over the place.
Bro, I don't think any of that went on him.
No.
But why the front yard? Why are you airing your dirty laundry, so to speak?
Humiliating him even more. Like, this, I'm pretty sure, is considered a form of torture, spraying someone with a hose.
Yeah, if you're going to be the martyr above it all, Brie de la Christ.
Yeah.
Maybe do it in the backyard to make it a little less humiliating.
Maybe.
I mean, maybe don't do it at all.
Definitely. Well, no, don't do it at all, but...
But the fact that she's doing it in front of, the whole neighborhood to see, I was like, oh my God, Brie, this is so messy.
Yeah.
Please stop.
So while she's spraying him with the hose, she yells at him to say please, which he eventually does scream out. And that's when sort of the floodgates open. And we do get a really wonderful sort of heartbreaking scene, which actually made me cry. Of Orson telling Brie how hard it is for him to have to now learn to ask for help for everything. And how he wishes he could just get up and make a cup of tea, but he can't because he has to wait for her. Which is actually, a really sad scene.
It was a great scene. Kyle MacLachlan is very talented.
He is incredibly talented.
I would feel for him a lot more if Orson wasn't such a bastard.
No, I know.
You know,
exactly.
He was like imprisoning his wife, and now he's manipulating his wife as much as he can to do the things that he wants because she's worried about not getting into heaven.
Mm.
He's just the worst kind of person.
Yeah. So the story for Brie and Orson ends with Brie apologizing and asking for Orson's forgiveness.
Yeah, maybe that they can actually rekindle the relationship and grow from this now.
Yeah.
Which we've been waiting for Orson to do for such a long time. Because if he's going to stick around, I don't want him to be an evil bastard for the whole time.
No.
It's time for him to move on and become a good guy again.
Yeah, we need a different evil bastard now. So finally, we have Lynette's storyline. And Lynette and Tom start by visiting Bob and Lee for sort of a couple's dinner, which seems to be going really well until Bob forgot to buy the whipped cream, which leads to a bit of a confrontation. What is it with these bitches and whipped cream in this episode?
Oh my God, they're fucking obsessed with the whipped cream.
Obsessed with whipped cream. Just go over to Breeze, guys. Right. She's got a whole bowl of it in her fridge.
Right.
So this leads to a bit of a confrontation, to which Lee accuses Bob of attacking him, and he goes to write in his feelings journal, and this is when they admit that they're seeing a counsellor. And it sounds like Bob wasn't really open for the idea at first, but it seems to really have helped the two of them.
But the arguing in front of Tom and Lynette at first, oh, tacky, yeah. Tacky.
Tacky.
Guys, come on.
Yeah. Tom then decides to openly suggest seeing someone to Lynette at the dinner table to help them out with our stuff.
Yeah, he couldn't just keep that in his head until they got home.
Until they got home. I would not have been happy with Tom in that moment. I would have been like, we are not talking about this at the dinner table.
Yeah, because just implying stuff like that in front of friends, how embarrassing for Lynette.
Yeah, like, ugh. I know Tom probably felt a little more comfortable to open up about that because Bob and Lee had just opened up that they're in counselling. So he's like, oh, they're in counselling. They're not going to judge us for it. But no. That's a personal thing that is discussed, not at a dinner table with friends.
More tacky behaviour at the dinner table, guys.
Yeah. So Tom really wants to give it a try, but Lynette hates therapy and thinks it's for weak, indulgent people.
Yep. She just about stops herself at the end, but we already heard weak and indulgent, and I think the damage...
Yeah.
The poison was already in the air.
She wants this topic dropped, but Bob does say that this woman is really great, and that's kind of where the scene ends. Kind of rude... for Lynette to say that when Bob and Lee have just admitted that they're a therapy, even though Lynette does say, not you guys though, you guys totally make it work.
Yeah, she's like, for straight couples.
Yeah, I know, like, what the fuck, Lynette? Jesus Christ.
Even though, let's be honest, in this economy, in this world, I think everyone needs therapy.
Everybody needs therapy. Nobody can afford it.
Except the conceptive.
Yeah. So moving on, Tom is writing in something, but he doesn't want to tell Lynette what it is, claiming they should respect boundaries. And it doesn't take her long to realise that it's Tom's own personal feelings journal, and that's when he admits he started seeing Bob and Lou's therapist. And it started out discussing the baby, but then apparently they've moved on to other things, and Lynette doesn't like the idea of being bitched about. She wants to read it, but Tom refuses, telling her that she'll just have to join him in therapy if she wants to know, which Lynette refuses.
Very interesting that she doesn't want to be bitched about, which is... Because it's like, I think you need therapy if that's the first thing you're worried about.
If that's, yeah, the first thing you're worried, oh, I don't want my husband bitching about me to somebody behind my back.
It's like, why do you think that's the first thing he's going to do? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Genius on Tom's side, though, because he knows that she's going to want to look in that journal.
Yeah, and he knows that she will do anything she can to know what he's being said about. So eventually, she would have fallen in line into therapy.
He knows what he's doing. He's planted a seed.
He has.
And he's letting Lynette water that thoroughly.
So it doesn't take long for Lynette to try to read Tom's feelings journal, but she is interrupted by him coming down the stairs, so she has to leave it.
Girl's cracking.
Yeah. So he goes to leave, and that's when she hands him the journal, but Tom is sure he would know if Lynette read it. She was like, don't you want to know if I read it?
His laugh, like, I'd know if you read it.
He's like, oh, if you read it, I'd know.
Okay, so maybe he is bitching about you then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We then cut to Lynette going to the therapist's office, and she steals some dude's appointment so she can talk to her instead. But not only does she steal his appointment, she gives him money, then asks what he wants to talk to his therapist about, which is pretty personal and not really something you should be asking anybody. And then she lets him go after giving him the $200 in cash and hearing that he's got gambling addiction.
It did happen, and I... it happened. And I was just like, I'm not really that surprised that she paid someone with a gambling addiction to take his spot.
No.
I've seen her do worse.
This does have one of my favourite all-time lines of Desperate Housewives, the scene.
Which one?
Which I quote it all the time. We then meet Dr. Graham, that's their counsellor, and Lynette wants to know what Tom has been saying to her from his big book of wah! Which I quote all the time.
When do you ever get the opportunity to quote that?
All the bloody time. I'm like, oh, if someone's miserable or pissed off, I'll always be like, oh, he's just going to go write about it in his big book of wah! So, unfortunately, Dr. Graham says that that information is confidential. And so Lynette thinks Tom describes her as a bitch. And slowly she begins to open up to the doctor about how she feels, how she behaves, why she behaves that way, and so on.
I mean, this therapist is good. The way that it didn't take that long for Lynette to be like, I just feel like I need to control everything.
No, I know.
I was like, wow, that came out quick.
This therapist is great. And this is honestly the weirdest way into therapy I've ever seen before in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lynette does essentially say that she has been bitchy recently, and, you know, that's because she's lost control of a few things in her life, like her baby dying.
Like your baby dying.
And she just likes to control things, and she gets a bit upset when she can't control things, which, weirdly enough, is an issue for Tom, but only like 5 or 6 episodes ago, Tom seemed to be quite accepting of that fact when he was talking to Roy about it.
Yeah, but I think that's just because he was sticking up for Lynette to this arsehole.
Maybe.
I don't know.
So, but yeah, so that is the episode, essentially. We end the episode quite rapidly, really, with Mary Alice talking about how we all turn to people who will listen, and we see Danny and Anna talking, and we see all the ladies sort of back together again at the Scrubs cafeteria, and then that's essentially where the episode ends.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. it was messy.
Yeah.
Everyone was so messy, so tacky. It was great.
It was a real messy episode. It was very funny.
It was very funny. So let's move on to our next segment then, where Joel is going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments of the episode, starting with the gayest moment.
So my award for gayest moment goes to Orson. For something that didn't even happen on screen, but just the image of it is hilarious, of him throwing himself out of his wheelchair as his physical therapist is walking in, so that it looks like he's fallen on the floor trying to reach the plate.
Oh, right. Yeah, the theatrics.
Which, the theatrics of that whole scene was incredibly gay. He's like, can somebody get me a piece of bread?
He's so dramatic.
It's like... so gay. That the theatre. Orson loves the theatre. He has it running through his veins, and he's just there like, oh, okay, bitch. I need to convince my physical therapist here that I'm in danger. I am going all out. I'm not bathing for a week, throwing myself on the floor.
He's acting like Joan Crawford in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment doesn't really go to anyone.
How come?
Because I just couldn't think of one.
Oh, that's a shame.
I could have given it to Tom for being like, where's dinner? Which is like cliche sexism right there.
It is, yeah.
Fine, okay, I'll give it to Tom.
Where's the dinner?
He's like, where's the beef, Lynette? Yeah. Where's the beef?
Where's the whipped cream, Lynette?
Come on, Lynette, got milk?
Where's the whipped cream?
I know. And now we move on to Bees Awards for Best and Worst Parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
Well, no one.
I'd say that's fair, really.
It was so messy.
Okay, so who do you have for the worst parent?
So, my award for...
worst parent of the episode.
I gave this to Angie. I know that you're probably expecting a Gabby or a Susan, but I had to give it to Angie for the way that she treated Anna at that dinner table. Oh my gosh, that was embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was about to say they both gave as good as they got, but actually Angie started it.
Yeah, she did.
She really did start it. So I therefore can't blame Anna for reacting the way that she reacted to Angie starting the feud.
Yeah, she acted offended because she didn't want to eat pasta. And then she basically said that she's going to end up being a prostitute or working in the porn industry. And I thought, lady, that's so judgy.
However, what we will say right here is there is nothing wrong with working in the porn industry if that is what you want to do.
Yeah. But what an assumption to make.
Yeah.
And also, she doesn't even know about her son's poetry.
No, she doesn't.
So that's who my award goes to. So bravo, bravo. Fucking bravo, everyone.
Well done, everyone.
That was Season 6, Episode 13, How About a Friendly Shrink? If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
So you can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview, and you can find us on Twitter at BFSreview.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and our artwork is done by Louis, who you can find on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign, and there's a link to his Etsy page where he does commissions.
Yes.
Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 6, Episode 14, The Glamorous Life.
Indeed. And remember, keep your fingers and toes crossed for us getting that house, bitches.
See you next time.
Bye.